the American government has systematically, fiercely fought against and defeated many Palestinian efforts at nonviolence.
Let's not forget that Hamas in 2006 barely squeaked by with a plurality, if not a majority, in Palestinian elections, and then turned its guns on fellow Palestinian factions with great violence.
Every single person I know who has gone to the West Bank and interacted with Palestinians in a human way, not as a soldier, as a settler, but trying to listen to Palestinians and engage with them as equals, no matter how Zionist they are, no matter how deep their background in terms of supporting Israel, come away from that experience profoundly shaken and changed.
Simply put, there's no systematic oppression of Palestinians. Their own leadership is responsible. Palestinians govern themselves. In the West Bank and Gaza, the Palestinians are ruled by the Palestinian Authority and Hamas, both of which are known for suppressing free speech, jailing dissidents, and canceling elections.
The oppression of the Palestinians in non-democratic Israel has been systematic and profound. Speaking for the affirmative, Peter Beinart. Peter, please come to the stage. Speaking for the negative, Michael Rubin. Michael, please come to the stage. Peter, you have 17 and a half minutes to establish the case for the affirmative. I think you'd like to take the podium. Take it away, Peter.
Sure.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. It's especially a pleasure to be with Mike, who is a very smart guy. I know he's a very smart guy because I've known him since he was 19 years old, when he had a little more hair than he does now. But even someone as smart and talented as Mike, I think, cannot refute this resolution. And frankly, I think people, you know, in the future will find it perhaps astonishing that we're even debating this question at all, just as we tend to look back and find it astonishing that there were people who defended other systems of pervasive and obvious oppression. The resolution is the oppression of Palestinians in non-democratic Israel has been systematic and profound. I think we can define non-democratic Israel as the parts of Israel where most of the people cannot become citizens and do not have the right to vote and cannot gain citizenship or the right to vote. The largest territory that falls in that category is the West Bank, with about 3 million Palestinians or so. The first thing to understand about the West Bank is that it is entirely under Israeli control. It is entirely under Israeli control. The Israel Defense Forces, Israel's military, can go into any square inch of any part of the West Bank anytime they want and arrest anyone they want. There is no other army that has the right to operate in the West Bank other than the Israeli military. Now, we may hear a little bit during the course of this debate about something called the Palestinian Authority. The Palestinian Authority was created in 1993. And serves as Israel's subcontractor in the West Bank. It does certain functions that Israel would rather not perform itself. In Palestinian population centers in the West Bank, it picks up the garbage, it runs the schools, it arrests car thieves. These are not things that the Israeli state is interested in doing itself. But it's critically important to understand that the Palestinian Authority is not a state, right? That's why people talk about the potential for a Palestinian state rather than suggesting that one exists today. The Palestinian Authority does not have and is not allowed to have an army. And the Palestinian Authority serves under the control of the Israeli state and the Israeli military. The officials of the Palestinian Authority, just like all Palestinians in the West Bank, need Israeli military permission if they want to travel. And sometimes Israel denies that. So in 2023, Israel denied the Palestinian Authority's foreign minister the right to travel outside the West Bank. Does that sound like someone who's the leader of his own state? In fact, there are a whole bunch of people elected to the Palestinian Authority's parliament who sit in Israeli jails. We may hear a little bit in this debate about something called Area A, B, and C of the West Bank. These were the divisions created by the Oslo Agreement in 1993 about the West Bank. And they're administered in somewhat different ways. But the critical thing to understand is that in Area A, B, and C of the West Bank, the Israeli military can go into any square inch of any of those territories it wants and arrest anyone it wants. Areas A and B are Palestinian population centers where Israel subcontracts certain functions to the Palestinian Authority. Area C, which is 60% of the West Bank, which is all the open land in between and where the Israeli settlements are, Israel controls, offers services directly. But Israel goes into areas A and B of the West Bank, the ones that we may hear claim are under the control of the Palestinian Authority. It goes into those areas of the West Bank too, all the time, and arrests anybody it wants. In fact, Israel is currently involved in a military initiative called Operation Iron Wall, which has involved the Israeli military going into refugee camps in Jenin, Tulkarem, Noshams, and Al-Farah camps. The reports, according to the UN, is that those military operations have led to the displacement of 40,000 Palestinians. All of those areas are in areas A and B, the areas of the West Bank that are supposedly not under Israeli control. If they're not under Israeli control, how come the Israeli military has been able to send its military into those areas and expel 40,000 people from their homes? The critical thing to understand about this territory, the West Bank, the critical thing to understand is that both Jews and Palestinians live there, and they live under completely different legal systems. Jewish settlers, Israeli settlers who live in the West Bank, are citizens of the State of Israel. They vote for the government of the State of Israel. They live under the same civil law as all other Israelis, which means they have due process, and they have free movement. Their Palestinian neighbors have none of those things. They are not citizens of the state that controls their lives. They cannot become citizens of the state. They cannot vote for the government that holds life and death power over them. None of those 40,000 people who've been expelled had the ability to vote for the government and register their opinion about whether they would prefer the Israeli military to come in and expel them from their homes. They don't have the right to vote for the government that has life and death power over them. Palestinians do not have free movement. They need Israeli military permission to travel, even within the West Bank, let alone to cross into Israel proper, the slice of territory that Israel created at its founding before it occupied the West Bank and other territories in 1967. And Palestinians live under military law. And according to the Israeli human rights group at B'Tselem and Yesh Din and others, that the prosecution rate in Israeli military courts for Palestinians exceeds 99%, and you can be held in indefinite detention. So if an Israeli Jew and a Palestinian get into a fight in the West Bank, they will go to two completely different legal systems. The Israeli Jew will have due process as a citizen. The Palestinian, as a stateless non-citizen, will go toward a military court where they can be held in essentially indefinite detention and where the prosecution rate exceeds 99%. So it is for these reasons that the world's leading human rights organizations, Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, as well as the International Court of Justice, have all said that Israel in the West Bank is practicing apartheid. Now, we may hear some talk about how the UN and the Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch are kind of leftist, anti-Israel, anti-Semitic institutions that can't be trusted. But I always notice that those same people who bash those organizations are very quick to, in fact, rely on them when they document human rights abuses in places like China and Venezuela and Cuba and Russia. It only seems to be when they document human rights abuses in Israel that all of a sudden they're completely illegitimate, right? But if you don't believe the world's most prominent human rights organizations, then you can look at Israel's leading human rights organizations, because Israel's two most prominent human rights organizations, B'Tselem and Yesh Din, have also found that Israel is practicing apartheid in the West Bank. But you might think that, you know, B'Tselem and Yesh Din, sure, okay, they are Israeli Jews, but, you know, they're leftists. They may be a little bit self-hating. They may be a little bit wacky. We can't really trust those guys either, right? So let me suggest a few other people that you might find a little bit more credible who would affirm the resolution that the oppression of Palestinians in non-democratic Israel, by which I particularly mean the West Bank, is systematic and profound. So there was a guy in 2010 who was talking about the territory of the West Bank. He called it the territory west of the Jordan River. He said, as long as in this territory west of the Jordan River, there is only one political entity called Israel, it is going to be either non-Jewish or non-democratic. If this block of millions of Palestinians, meaning in the West Bank, cannot vote, that will be an apartheid state. That was Ehud Barak, Israel's former prime minister. Then there's another quote I'll offer you. This is a person talking about Palestinian life in the West Bank. This gentleman said, we are making the lives of millions unbearable, and it kills me. That quote comes from Carmi Gilon, who led the Shin Bet, Israel's domestic security service, the security service that oversees the West Bank. He led the Shin Bet from 1995 to 1996. I guess another self-hating radical, self-hating Jew radical leftist who can't be trusted. Then we have this quote, we've become a brutal occupation force. That's from Avraham Shalom, who ran the Shin Bet from 1981 to 1986, right? I dare say that Carmi Gilon and Avraham Shalom have spent a lot more time in military prisons in the West Bank, in detention camps, than Michael Rubin or I ever will. There was a famous Israeli philosopher, one of my heroes, who wrote many years ago, who prophesized when Israel took over the West Bank, that, quote, a state ruling over a hostile population of 1 million foreigners will necessarily become a Shin Bet state. The corruption found in every colonial regime will affix itself to the state of Israel. That quote was from a famous Israeli Orthodox social critic named Yeshayahu Leibovitz. In the film The Gatekeepers, which I would highly recommend you watch if you haven't, which is a documentary of interviews with former heads of the Shin Bet, another former head of the Shin Bet, Yuval Diskin, who ran the Shin Bet from 2005, was confronted by the documentarian with that quote, and Diskin answered, I agree with every word he wrote. So if you don't believe Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International and the UN, and you don't believe Yesh Din and B'Tselem, you can at least believe the very Israeli security officials who oversaw this system of profound and systematic oppression. Thanks.
Michael Rubin for the negative. Take it away, Michael.
Thank you very much. I want to thank the Soho Forum and also Peter for this cordial debate. I'd also like to begin, as I think is necessary, with a land acknowledgement. The New York City Commission on Human Rights acknowledges the land politically designated as New York City to be the homeland of the Lenape, who were violently displaced as a result of European settler colonialism over the course of 400 years. To suggest that human rights law would permit the Lenape to detonate a suicide vest in Columbia's Butler Library or in this hall would be morally perverse. Peter doesn't mention terrorism. Unfortunately, we can't avoid it. Now, as a historian, I get paid to predict the past, and Peter might suggest I only get that right about half the time. But historically, one of the problems inherent in land disputes is that migrations were constant. Even prior to the arrival of Europeans, Native Americans moved and migrated. War, famine, and environment all caused movements. During World War II, war forced more than 50 million Europeans to leave their homes and resettle elsewhere. Approximately 100,000 came to Palestine. Is Israel a democracy? Yes. Look, we may not like Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He's a cynic. He's arrogant, and I find many of his policies abhorrent. But the outcome of Israeli elections are uncertain until votes are cast. Mahmoud Abbas, the chairman of the Palestinian Authority, is now 89 years old and in the 20th year of his four-year presidential term. Suggesting Israel is not a democracy is like suggesting Ukraine is a dictatorship. I won't even begin to talk about Hamas, where at best you have one man, one vote, one time. Now, Israel has a pluralistic political system with 13 parties in parliament, more than most democracies, with a low 3.25% electoral threshold, lower than most democracies, ensuring broad representation, including two largely Arab parties, as well as a party that is dedicated to anti-Zionism. The opposition in Israel is active and more powerful than in most Western democracies. Look, some of you know that I have a bounty on my head for having been a little bit too antagonistic to Recep Tayyip Erdogan. A $900,000 bounty on my head. My wife had said that if only he knew that I snored, he could have had me for a lot less. But there's a joke I hear in Turkey about a Turkish professor who makes an unfortunate comment about the president, and he ends up in prison, and he goes into prison, and he's got 20 years because of his tweet or whatever he said, and he goes in with a whole list of books because he's a lot of time on his hands. And the prison librarian looks over the list and said, "Oh, I'm so sorry. We don't have any of these books. We only have the authors." That's not the case in Israel, where the opposition is vocal. Israel's liberal Supreme Court frequently rules against the government, demonstrating judicial independence. The protests against judicial reform were protests against a proposal that would have actually brought Israel in line with the United States and most European democracies when it came to confirmation hearings for judges and that sort of thing. There are full civil rights for minorities, Arabs, women, LGBTQ+. Individuals enjoy full rights, often with more protections than in Western countries. Now, make no mistake, I'm in favor of a two-state solution. Frankly, I believe in a three-state solution because I think the political cultural gap between the West Bank and Gaza right now is too great to overcome. That's not a bad thing. There's two Romanias, one of which is called Moldova. There's two Albanias, one of which is called Kosovo, and there's 22 Arab states. Much of the debate about whether Israel is democratic revolves around different regimens in Israel proper versus the disputed territories. The distinction is important as it begs the question, occupied from whom and when? When did the independent state of Palestine exist? Did Jordan and Egypt occupy it prior to 1967? Did the Ottoman Empire occupy it? Who was its founding president and king? It is extraordinarily dangerous to declare a state retroactively in order to declare resistance legal. That said, Israel is not the same as the West Bank or Gaza, nor should it be treated as such. Now, many pundits and politicians say Israel cannot retain both its democratic and Jewish character so long as occupation persists, and then they give demographic statistics to suggest that Israel represents a Jewish minority or soon-to-be Jewish minority lording over non-Jewish and Arab majority. When Peter and I were at Yale together, Peter Salove, who would rise to become the university's president, assigned Daryl Huff's 1945 book, How to Lie with Statistics, to force students to analyze critically. While many in the media and activist community take Palestinian statistics at face value, let's look at these statistics. Here are the problems. The Palestinian Central Bureau of Statistics counts Jerusalem's population, so Jerusalem is counted twice in these figures. The UN in 2006 assumed natural growth was around 3.5% for Palestinians. The Palestinian Central Bureau of Statistics decreed an improbable 6.6%. Nor will Palestinian statisticians accept emigration. Every Palestinian who's left the West Bank or Gaza permanently resides there. If the Middle East, it's the Middle East equivalent of residents of Chicago graveyards finding themselves on voting rolls decades after their deaths. Now let's talk about land use. Problems exist within Israel, but Arabs can buy private land, 7% of the country, or at least state-owned land, 80% of Israel, much like Jews do. The remaining 13% is owned by the Jewish National Fund and is usually just parks or national forests. This simply is not apartheid. To suggest otherwise reflects the triumph of polemic over reality. Indeed, the closest parallel to apartheid in the Middle East exists in Bahrain, where sect determines permissible living areas. Now, when it comes to immigration, Anit Wolf, a former Labour Party MK member of the Knesset, noted that the lands the United Nations allocated for the Jewish state were those that the early Zionists reclaimed through land purchase and the draining of malarial swamps. The Arab influx from today's Syria coincided with malaria eradication. Now, here's a quote. Since Peter is fond of quotes, I'll give a few. "The Arab immigration into Palestine since 1921 has vastly exceeded the total Jewish immigration during the whole period, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt observed on the cusp of World War II. Nor was Roosevelt alone. C.S. Jarvis, the British governor of the Sinai from 1922 to 1936, noted the illegal Arab immigration coming, quote, from not only from the Sinai, but also from Transjordan and Syria. The price of real estate soared. And the British-sponsored Peel Commission reported in 1937 that a shortfall of land is, we consider, due less to the amount of land acquired by Jews than to the increase in the Arab population. Now, historically, no one denies large immigration of European Jews to Palestine beginning in the late 19th century. While the 1948 war led many Arabs to leave Palestine, some by choice and others not, the Arab narrative largely forgets an equal, if not greater, compulsion of Jews to leave Arab countries. As the UN Watch's Hillel Nora once asked before the UN Human Rights Council, Algeria, where are your Jews? Now, if we take the same definition of Palestinian refugee that the United Nations Relief and Works Agency used, and we apply it to the partition of India, then today there are 250 million refugees between India and Pakistan. The fact of the matter is, there is a problem here, but we also need to address it as a problem that exists in much of the rest of the world, as opposed to its own special case. Now, what's unique today, actually, is the number of Palestinians seeking to move into Israel. As peace potentially nears and a division of Jerusalem comes with it, many East Jerusalem Arabs are actually moving to central Jerusalem neighborhoods so they do not lose access to the Jewish state by falling on the Palestinian side of the border. More than 6,000 Lebanese Christian Arabs moved to Israel as Hezbollah took over southern Lebanon in May 2000. How many dictatorships see immigration? How many people immigrate to Turkey or Egypt or Burma or Cuba? How many to apartheid South Africa? Now, Israel's concern with regard to terrorism is real, and it cannot simply be explained away by occupation. In 1946, the intelligence office of the Department of War, the predecessor of the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency, estimated that the greatest over-the-horizon threats to U.S. national security were communism and Islamist terror. Communism was a given, given what was going on with the Azerbaijan crisis. Islamist terror, this is before the partition of Palestine. This is before the creation of the State of Israel. What they were looking at was the Muslim Brotherhood ideology, which was running roughshod over Egypt at the time, sparking a lot of violence. The issue's ideology, the philosophy of the Muslim Brotherhood, which, by the way, Hamas has evolved from. Now, I feel for Palestinians, but it's condescending to hold them to different standards. It's also condescending to deny them agency for their own actions. Peter focuses his work on Israel and the Palestinians. My work is a little bit broader. I remember visiting Mosul and Raqqa, for example, the capital of the Islamic State in Syria, just after liberation. What I saw was astounding. What I saw were ruins. I mean, driving into Raqqa, Syria, I was passing kilometers and kilometers and kilometers of destroyed buildings. And when I would interview people in Raqqa, they didn't say to the Americans who were involved in that urban warfare, why didn't you pause? Why didn't you provide food to the Islamic State? Urban warfare is, there's no magic solution here. But we need to recognize that what we see with regard to Gaza has its roots in the same problem that we saw with regard, for example, to the Islamic State. Now, it's also wrong to say this is a noxious ideology, but they control land. We just need to deal with it. Thank God the world didn't say that when it came to the Khmer Rouge. And while we're talking about Nobel Prize winning human rights organizations, let's not forget that the American Friends Service Committee actually endorsed the Khmer Rouge and said all this about killing fields was just capitalist propaganda. This is in Gwenter Louie's book on the politics of pacifism. The fact of the matter is that sometimes human rights groups can get things wrong or can be guided more by the politics than the principle. Now, prior to Hamas's October 7th, 2023 attack on Israel, And that was during a ceasefire, no less. Let's not forget that. Life in Gaza was not easy, but also let's not exaggerate. According to the CIA's World Factbook for 2023, life expectancy for Gaza was well above the world average and also above Serbia, Egypt, Colombia, Kazakhstan, and South Africa. Infant mortality was less than in Egypt, Turkey, Morocco, and South Africa. Unemployment was bad, but still better than in South Africa and Kosovo. There are more mobile phones than in Puerto Rico or Bosnia. Ditto internet access. Simply put, there's no systematic oppression of Palestinians. Their own leadership is responsible. Palestinians govern themselves. In the West Bank and Gaza, the Palestinians are ruled by the Palestinian Authority and Hamas, both of which are known for suppressing free speech, jailing dissidents, and canceling elections. Peace rejection and terrorism matters. The Palestinian Authority has rejected multiple peace offers, including Camp David in 2000 and then in 2008, where they would have had not only a state, but more than 100% of the territory of the West Bank and Gaza when land swaps were taken into account. The claim that Gaza is a prison is false. Gaza has a border with Egypt, yet Egypt keeps it closed due to Hamas's terror activities. Israel withdrew fully from Gaza in 2005, but instead of building a prosperous state, Hamas destroyed Israeli book greenhouses and turned Gaza into a terror base. Look, Peter's been to Gaza more than I have. I've been to Gaza in the West Bank. But when I was in Gaza, I didn't see, nor was I shown by those with whom I was with, the terror tunnels, which are actually longer, more extensive than the North Vietnamese tunnel system. You can't say that you can't assume that you're getting the straight truth from your interlocutors if somehow they miss the fact that underneath the hospitals, underneath the schools, are 300 miles worth of tunnels, which are being used as bomb factories or to keep women and children prisoner. The claim of Israeli racism is also a lie. Israel's strong relations with Arab nations, including the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Morocco, Sudan, Egypt, and Jordan, all of which they have peace with right now. Arabs in Israel have full rights and political freedoms. They serve as diplomats, scientists, doctors, actors. Now, those who aren't under Israeli law, that's because Israel doesn't recognize them as part of Israel. The whole point of the Oslo process was to have Palestine become independent, to have that two-state solution. And if it weren't for the terrorism, we would be much closer there. Now, look, I've spent time in South Sudan, which is a mess. But I've also spent, and I took my 9-year-old daughter with me on one of these trips, to Somaliland, which doesn't get any international assistance. And yet, and we give $2 billion plus to Somalia. Somaliland is thriving. It's got the second largest Coca-Cola bottling plant in Africa. It's got now, according to the World Bank, one of the best, most efficient deep water ports. It's got 99% penetration of mobile money. The fact of the matter is that people have agency. When I'm in Al Anbar, you guys remember Fallujah and Ramadi? When I'm in Al Anbar, it's glistening like Iraqi Kurdistan. And let's talk about Iraqi Kurdistan, which is how, when Peter was my editor for the new, when he was my editor and I was contributing to the New Republic, in Iraqi Kurdistan, you had embargoes by Saddam Hussein, you had embargoes by the United Nations, but the Kurds decided on their own to build up their society rather than spend the money on terror. We have to look at reality in these in this regard. Now, with that, I think I've been a little bit provocative. Peter certainly has as well, but why don't I turn the floor back over?
Thank you, Michael. Peter, 7.5 minutes of rebuttal. Take it away, Peter.
Thank you. So as you can see, Mike is a smart guy and he knows about a lot of stuff. South Sudan, Somaliland, where they evidently have a great Coke bottling plant, Raqqa, Mosul, Fallujah, India, Pakistan, Burma, Cuba, Azerbaijan, the Khmer Rouge, the problematic relationship that the American Friends Services Committee has with the Khmer Rouge. He suggested we talk about Kurdistan, but the debate is not about Kurdistan. None of that has anything to do with this, right? My point is really, really simple, right? Even if I were to concede everything that Michael wanted to say about Israel within the 1967 lines, right, where Palestinian citizens suffer discrimination but do have the right to vote, it wouldn't change the fact that in 1967, Israel occupied a series of territories, the largest of which is the West Bank, where 3 million Palestinians live. And those Palestinians live under Israeli control, and they live under a completely different legal system than their Jewish neighbors, right? And the only, virtually the only thing in this very, very long and comprehensive and detailed statement that Michael said about the situation in the West Bank is that Palestinians there govern themselves. No, they don't govern themselves. They don't. They live under the control of the Israeli state. That's why the Israeli military is right now expelling tens of thousands of people from Palestinian refugee camps in the West Bank. It's why Israel goes in, you know, every week or every month or every day and takes Palestinians all out of their homes in the West Bank and throws them into jail. It's why even the Palestinian Authority officials can be thrown into jail and are by the Israeli military, right? So it just seemed to me, while Mike said a lot of really, really interesting stuff, very little of it actually bears on the question, because what he has to argue is this system in the West Bank of two completely different legal systems, one for Jews and one for Palestinians, is that not profound and systematic discrimination when Israel's own human rights organizations, the World Human Rights Organizations, the UN, and even many of Israel's security officials say, indeed it is. And this is not something temporary, right? Israel was created in 1948, right? It took the West Bank in 1967. The vast majority of Israel's history, it has controlled this territory. I defy you to find a single member of the Israeli government who would say that its control over the West Bank is temporary, right? When last year they held an election in the Knesset on whether on the idea of a Palestinian state, there was not a single member of a Jewish political party who voted yes, right? Israel has not just allowed, but subsidized and poured millions and millions and millions of dollars into subsidizing massive Israeli settlement in the West Bank with the express purpose of ensuring that Israel would maintain permanent control over the West Bank, right? Michael said about Turkey that when you go to that you go to jail in Turkey, you won't find books, but you'll find a lot of authors, right? Well, I have news for you. You find a lot of Palestinian authors, especially from the West Bank, in Israeli prisons as well, because they don't have basic due process and basic rights. In fact, there's something in the West Bank called Military Order 101, which gives the Israeli which says that 10 or more Palestinians are not allowed to assemble for a political purpose without a prior permit from the military government, from the Israeli military. Unless you have the permission of the Israeli military, you can't have more than 10 people assemble for a political purpose, even in a private home. Does that sound like a free environment to you? Does that sound like a situation in which you're not likely to end up in jail if you defy the Israeli military? It's absurd. There are huge numbers of Palestinian writers and intellectuals and artists of all sorts who end up in Israeli jails because Israel is radically unaccountable to them, because they don't have the basic protections of voting rights and civil law and due process and citizenship that could protect you from the state. So again, there's a lot of stuff that we could talk about that Michael said, some of which I might agree with, some of what I might disagree with. But the heart of the motion is, for this motion to be wrong, you have to argue that two separate legal systems, one in which Jews enjoy full rights of citizenship, voting rights, free movement, and due process, and Palestinians in the West Bank enjoy none of those things, you have to argue that somehow that's not systematic and profound oppression. And I just didn't hear Michael do that.
Okay. 7.5 minutes. 7.5 minutes of rebuttal. Take it away, Michael.
Sorry, just a second. I was setting my timer. Okay. I think I know where we're going, where we're different. Look, there's a couple issues that separate Peter and I and our interpretations of this. One has to do with agency and accountability. In Peter's perspective, what happens to the Palestinians is done to the Palestinians. It's entirely one way. There's not a reaction. There's not a sense within Palestinian society in the Gaza Strip or the West Bank, and there's not a single Palestinian society, that our actions actually bear consequence. You know, Somaliland, maybe I misspoke, isn't just about a Coca-Cola bottling plant. It's also the first country in the world, even though completely unrecognized, that invested its money to secure 8 elections with biometric iris scans to secure the sanctity of those elections. The other issue has to do with occupation, the fact that Palestine is going to become a state. There's a two-state solution out there. Mahmoud Abbas may not particularly be someone that Peter likes, and frankly, I don't think many Palestinians like him. Otherwise, he wouldn't be in the 20th year of his 4-year term. He would have had other elections. But the fact of the matter is that when countries recognize the state of Palestine, they're not recognizing Hamas as the apex of Palestinian society. They're recognizing the Palestinian Authority, which under the Oslo Accords does have real decisions. And as Peter knows, because we've both been to Ramallah, Israelis aren't normally allowed in Ramallah. Now, when the United States occupied Iraq or Afghanistan, we can argue about the wisdom of those decisions under George W. Bush. But the fact of the matter is, the second we occupied Afghanistan, the fact that we didn't apply American law to Afghanistan did not make us an apartheid state, nor did it make us systematically undemocratic. There's a different, I mean, what would be undemocratic is if Israel annexed that territory and then maintained two different systems of law. But when we talk about Jewish political parties and so forth, the fact of the matter is most Israeli political parties aren't simply Jewish. They're ideological. They're center left. They're center right. They dispute economics, but they include Arabs. They include Druze. They include different types of Jews and so forth. The fact of the matter is there isn't that systematic discrimination. And it's not only a perversity to describe Israel in that fashion, but it actually does harm to those that suffer real discrimination in other places. Again, the situation, if there was a magic formula with regard to Israel and the Palestinians, it would have been, the problem would have been resolved by now. This notion, however, that Israel is never going to intend to hand back the West Bank, someone should actually tell Yitzhak Rabin that. They should think about the 2000 Camp David II Accords. They should think about Ehud Olmert, who Peter quoted, and the 2008 peace agreement, which was rejected by the Palestinians and would have enabled that state. If you want Michael Rubin's personal way forward on this, I would take those areas, Jericho, Bethlehem, which are much more functional and much more peaceful and don't pose security concerns to the same degree, and recognize Palestinian independence. That's my personal view. And as other groups come in, other areas come into line, they can join. But the fact of the matter is, Palestinians, Palestine, they're not the only people that are struggling against the backdrop of a land dispute. They are, however, further back in their quest for independence and a functional state simply because of the choices which they have made. And even though in Peter's book, for example, he argues that the revisions to Hamas's genocidal convention, its constitution, so to speak, are much more sincere. The 2017 versus 1988 covenant. But the fact of the matter is, Hamas's words and the words of their leader show that there is an existential rejection of Israel. And that poses a problem which can't simply be dismissed with the world with a wave of pen. Look, I wish we lived in a situation where we could simply out-hug our enemies. And I'm not saying all Palestinians are enemies. They're not. They wouldn't be migrating into Israel if they were enemies and if they couldn't live together with the Jewish state. But groups like Hamas are the same as groups like the Islamic State or the Khmer Rouge. They possess an ideology which they alone are at fault for perpetrating. And if they would take the examples of Somaliland or the Kurds or any of these other peoples who have made changes for the benefit of their people, we wouldn't necessarily be in this protracted conflict. Unfortunately, many people profit from the perpetration of conflict. And again, you don't need to ask me. In 1951, UNRWA itself reported to the United Nations General Assembly that there would be tremendous moral hazard and the perpetuation of conflict unless UNRWA was able to basically work itself out of a job within 3 years by resettling Palestinians wherever they had resided, wherever they now resided, much like Israel had done with the Jewish migrants who were forced out of places like Iraq, Algeria, Morocco, Libya, Egypt, and so forth. Again, we can question back and forth. A lot more to say, but thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Michael. We now come to the Q&A portion of the evening. I'm going to exercise moderator's prerogative, ask a question. I guess we ought to, guys, I know that Ken, our assistant, is going to go around to people who want to raise their hands. I think maybe the lights in the audience should be raised. But for the moment, I want to just take moderator's prerogative to ask a question and then invite the two debaters if they want to ask a question. Just one question that I want to put to both of you, but first to Peter. I gather that, Peter, that some people in the audience, and what I infer a little bit from what Michael is saying, although I don't necessarily want to speak for him, but speak for those who have an issue, that the attack by Hamas in October, which killed a lot of Israelis, the idea that Michael suggested seemed to have mentioned that the two-state solution has been rejected by the Palestinians indicates that Israel is dealing with a group of people in the West Bank and in Gaza who negate Israel's right to exist and who therefore have to be treated in the same way that the U.S. treated those in Afghanistan. What do you have to say to that position, Peter?
Sure. Well, Michael mentioned Afghanistan, too. You know, if the United States had taken control of Afghanistan for 6 decades, moved Americans in, imposed 2 different legal systems, one for Afghans and one for Americans, right, and maintained control of that territory for 60 years with 2 different legal systems, then I think, yes, you could probably say that America would have been practicing apartheid in Afghanistan. The truth is that every power that controls a group of people and denies them basic human rights, denies them equality, denies the basic freedom, always has a justification, right? The justification is usually something about the fact that these people aren't ready for freedom. They're behind culturally. They're kind of savage, and that they represent a security threat. I mean, this is the way white South Africans talk about Black South Africans. It's the way white Americans talk during slavery and segregation. It's the way that French colonialists and British colonialists, not unique to Israel, right? And the truth is that people who are under oppression, who are being denied basic rights, are not saints, right? What Hamas did on October 7th was horrifying, right? It was horrifying, right? What the Algerian rebels did during French colonialism, there were things that were totally horrifying. The Mau Mau revolt in Kenya was horrifying. Even as the African National Congress was not a nonviolent organization, it explicitly could practice armed resistance and got its weapons from the Soviet Union, right? But the point is, you don't have to be a population of saints, right, to deserve the same basic freedoms that everybody else enjoy, right, and not to be under a legal system that's classified as apartheid. And I would just say, just the last thing I would say is that even if we were to get, we can get into the questions of the peace negotiations in 2000, 2007, but nobody, even if you believe that the Palestinian leadership made serious mistakes that have hurt their people, it is not the Palestinians that have been paying Israelis to move Israeli Jews into the West Bank, subsidizing settlement on a massive scale and taking control of more and more of the territory on which a Palestinian state would exist, right? That was not done by the Palestinians. That's been done by successive Israeli governments, virtually every Israeli government since the 1970s. That even when Palestinians do exactly what Israel wants them to do, when Salam Fayyad was prime minister, and the Israelis and Americans used Salam Fayyad because he was so opposed to violence, because he was fighting corruption. I would encourage you to read the exit interview he did with Roger Cohen when he left Palestinian politics. He said, "I couldn't stop Israeli settlement growth for one day, and it completely discredited me," right? So even when Palestinians do the things that Israel wants, they still end up moving further and further away from having basic freedom.
Michael, oh my God. Was that missed by the mic? Lucas?
A little bit.
Oh my gosh.
Oh. Sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
Okay. that's my fault. Most of it was caught. I think we'll be okay. Michael, do you want to comment on what you heard Peter just say?
I'm glad actually Peter gave the example of Mandela in South Africa, because what allowed Mandela to succeed wasn't doubling down on the violence that characterized the ANC's early years. It was actually recognizing that if he wanted to build a state, if he wanted to defeat apartheid, that he would actually need to act like a statesman. Nelson Mandela deserves full credit. He didn't simply want to play the victim. He didn't simply want to posture. He made real reforms and understood that no one but himself was responsible for the policy decisions he made. And thank God he made the right policy decisions.
Can I say something about that?
Yes, especially since you might have been missed a little bit in terms of audio. Could you elaborate a little bit on what you were saying? Go ahead.
Sure. I was saying that if the United States controlled Afghanistan for six decades and set up two legal systems, one for Americans and one for Afghans, I think it would be practicing apartheid. Secondly, I said that even when Palestinians do the very things that Israel wants them to do, like Salam Fayyad, and virulently oppose armed resistance and fight corruption, that Salam Fayyad himself said he couldn't stop Israeli settlement growth for one day, and therefore he was discredited because Palestinians moved further and further away from a state and basic freedom. Now, I want to make it clear. I don't see Nelson Mandela as the equivalent of Hamas. Nelson Mandela and the ANC, to their great credit, did make much more of an effort to avoid civilian targets. And Hamas, to its shame, has often targeted civilians most egregiously on October 7th. But it's also important that we should not, in retrospect, sanitize this, right? Nelson Mandela and the ANC were considered a terrorist organization by the United States. And in fact, I don't think Michael would be speaking this way about Mandela at all in the 1990s. Certainly the American Enterprise Institute, where he works, was not speaking about Mandela this way. They were among the people who actually were warning that the ANC was a communist terrorist organization that we could not allow to rule South Africa. On the question of violence, when Mandela was imprisoned in Polsmoor prison, the South African government went to him repeatedly and said, "We want to let you out. We're afraid you're going to die in jail and we'll have more radical black leaders. We only ask one thing, renounce violence." And you know what Mandela said again and again, reportedly six times? He said, "I will renounce violence on the day we have a date for a free election." Right. So I think that, again, it's always easy to justify oppression in the present and pretend and sanitize the opposition to oppression in the past. But the very same people in American politics who today defend Israeli apartheid are the same kinds of people who defended Israeli apartheid. That was a mainstream position in the Republican Party and on the American right in the 1980s.
I want to ask now you a question, Michael. Maybe you can sandwich in your remarks here, but you seem to have made your factual statement clear that you favor a two, or as you put it, possibly three-state solution, with the West Bank and Gaza being two separate states. But you are saying that while the Israelis have offered that kind of solution, the Palestinians have consistently turned it down. Is that a fair summary of your depiction of the facts?
Yes. Now, to try to sandwich yes with a response to what Peter said, I would just point out, first of all, I'm several months younger than Peter, and so I wasn't at even though I am grayer, I wasn't at the American Enterprise Institute when we were both at college. And the American Enterprise Institute's sort of like NYU where you work, where we each take individual rather than institutional
CUNY,
positions.
Actually, I teach at CUNY.
But... CUNY, sorry. With regard to Hamas and this notion of elections and Nelson Mandela, let's not forget that Hamas in 2006 barely squeaked by with a plurality, if not a majority, in Palestinian elections, and then turned its guns on fellow Palestinian factions with great violence. And there hasn't been an election since. Again, Peter doesn't like other analogies. He seems to want me to try to constrain the debate to only one example. But in Somaliland, the portion of Somalia that decided it didn't want to go into Black Hawk Down, sort of failed state territory in 1991, has had 8 successive presidential elections without outside assistance, one of which was decided by 86 votes out of a million cast. And it's had 8 peaceful transitions of power. There's no one stopping the Palestinians from embracing peace. The fact of the matter is, terrorism isn't resolved by TED Talks. The fact of the matter is, individual accountability matters. And I would say it's been, and this is one of the things that has most hurt the Palestinian cause, is the willingness of the international community almost to condescend and to treat them as if they don't have agency, if they're not, that they're not going to be held to the same standards as the Indians, the Pakistanis, and everyone else. All that does is perpetuate conflict. It doesn't allow the rebuilding to occur, as has occurred in so many other areas, which is why so many other aspirants to statehood have passed them by.
Same question for you, Peter. I believe, again, Michael has stated that the 2 or 3 state solution, which he favors, has been offered by Israel a number of times, has been rejected by the Palestinians a number of times. Do you agree with that depiction of the history of what's been going on?
Look, Michael is a very smart guy, as I said, and if this were a debate about Somaliland, he would kick my butt, right? There's no question about it. The problem is, with all due respect, when I hear folks like Michael say they support the two-state solution, I don't believe them. I don't believe them, because if you support a two-state solution, you should be spending, you should be working frantically to try to stop Israeli settlement growth in the West Bank, because it's not complicated, right? You can't have a viable, contiguous Palestinian state if Israel is taking more and more of the land in the heartland of what would that be, that state. I'm curious, how many columns and speeches has Michael given about trying to stop settlement growth? Is he open to the idea that America should condition its military aid on an end to settlement growth, right? Has the American Enterprise Institute ever lobbied, right, for resolutions at the UN to condemn Israeli settlement growth, right? If you don't do anything to try to stop Israeli settlement growth, and indeed you support a position of basically unconditional U.S. support for Israel as Israel makes a Palestinian state impossible, and then you say, I support a two-state solution, it's like someone saying, Peter, what's your position on running the New York Marathon? And I say, my position is I support running the New York Marathon. And then they say, well, are you doing any running? And I say, no, I generally sit on my couch and eat chocolate cake, right? Well, then my actual position is not that I support, that I want to run the New York Marathon, right? And that's what I hear when I hear folks like Michael say they support a two-state
solution. Okay, we are gonna give you guys the chance to ask each other questions, but we've been scanning the audience. Ken, could you go to somebody who's raised their hand? No need to identify yourself, and please ask a question as a question and address it to whomever you want, or to both of them if you'd like. Take it away.
Does who own the land matter in this debate? I'm hearing you guys talk a lot about different legal systems. One idea is undocumented immigrants in the U.S., different legal system. Is that oppression? Like, I don't really know.
Does who own the land matter in this case? Peter, can you address that?
I don't think the situation of Palestinians in the West Bank who lived there, were born there, lived their entire lives, their parents were born there, their parents lived there their entire lives, their grandparents, in many cases, were born there, lived their entire their lives, is in any way remotely equivalent to the situation of an undocumented immigrant who comes in to the United States. I may have a lot of criticisms about how the United States, particularly now, is treating undocumented immigrants. But we're not talking about people who migrated from another place. We're talking about people, you know, who are always there, right? And then Israel takes control of the territory in 1967, right? Dominates, has life and death control over them, but denies them for more than almost 60 years now, denies them the most basic of human rights while giving those human rights to the Israeli Jews who then move into the West Bank.
Could you comment on that question and answer, Michael?
Well, first of all, I'm shocked. I'm shocked that Peter supports apartheid in the United States by having a different system for undocumented aliens, some of whom are multi-generational. But I say that, of course, with tongue in cheek. I know you don't.
I appreciate that.
And I also would point out that nonprofits like the American Enterprise Institute don't lobby. So don't try to get me audited by the IRS. I don't lobby. But I have written many things in favor of, for example, the 2008 peace deal that was offered by Ehud Barak, which included land swaps in order to allow the Palestinians more than 100% of the total. The whole point of peace negotiations, rather than the unilateral actions in the terrorism, is to try to address what, in essence, are disputed territories, in which we can start with regard to the 1949 armistice lines. But then we also have to recognize that the Israelis, or I should say Jews, were expelled from Jerusalem in 1948. There were pogroms in Hebron that expelled the population. And we can go back. There's no shortage of grievances on both sides of this. The fact of the matter is, however, that when we are talking about settlements, the position of the United States government has long been to oppose these random outliers, these trailers which are put up in the middle of nowhere. But if you're talking about, and this is something which B'Tselem is guilty of, if you're talking about adding a third floor because you have a baby to your two-story building, that's natural growth. That's not the same qualitatively and quantitatively, and we can't try to elide this. The fact of the matter is, if you're going to have a settlement freeze, the settlement freeze should be on both sides. You're going to have land swaps in any agreement, and it's time to get moving on the peace agreement. But the whole basis of the peace negotiations was twofold: recognition of the existence of Israel and a forswearing of terrorism. And there's no way to sort of say, well, we're going to forgive those two clauses and make progress. It goes back to 1993, and it goes back beforehand.
Okay, next question.
Thank you. For you, Mr. Rubin, quick question about specifically the 2018 basic law that arrogates the right for national self-determination exclusively to the Jewish people, downgrades the status of the Arabic language, and decides that Jewish settlement is a national value in Israel. Could you address that? How does that factor in with your answer of whether Israel is democratic or Jewish or both at the same time?
Okay. Well, I mean, first of all, like I said, I don't necessarily agree with Netanyahu all the time. But let me put it this way. Israel, when we talk about basic laws, Israel is a lot like the United Kingdom in that it doesn't have a formal constitution. It has a series of basic laws. The notion of defining Israel as a Jewish state, in which you're also going to have equal rights for non-Jews, is quite similar to what we see in many European democracies, many East Asian democracies, and it's far more generous than what we see in 22 different Arab states. One comment that is constantly brought about when Mahmoud Abbas or others are asked about in a future Palestinian state whether they would allow Jews to live there under Palestinian law. If those who settled there, the answer is absolutely not. That's the true apartheid. When one of the disputes which Benjamin Netanyahu has right now, and this is something to be negotiated, is this notion of, is it a two-state solution, or is it a two-state solution in which we recognize that one state is a Jewish state? Because what we hear from a lot of Hamas theoreticians is, we believe in a two-state solution. It's just Hamas should control both of those. So this that basic law issue is trying to get to the heart of Israeli identity, much like German identity, Swedish identity, and so forth. I don't see it in as exaggerated a fashion as we often do. We often discuss this issue with regards to the Israeli-Palestinian situation. And I would also notice that note in conclusion that the Israeli Supreme Court is very active in defining how many of these issues should be applied in a way which make many people on the liberal or progressive left, including myself, quite happy.
Comment from you, Peter.
Sure. Just as on the difference between Israel and some of the European countries that Michael is talking about. First of all, again, we can't ignore the fact that the most of the Palestinians under Israeli control lack citizenship, cannot get citizenship, and don't have the right to vote for the government that has life and death power over them, including the people in Gaza right now, right, who are being killed as we speak, and the Palestinians in the West Bank and the Palestinians in East Jerusalem. Even in Israel proper, right, which we might say is more democratic because Palestinian citizens, Arab Israelis, have the right to vote, Israel has a segregated school system, right? It has one set of schools for Palestinian citizens and then several other sets of schools for Jews based on their degree of religiosity. Israel has no civil marriage, which means that a Jew cannot marry a Muslim or a Christian inside Israel, right? 93% of the land or so in Israel proper, I'm not talking about the West Bank now, is under the control of the Israel Land Authority. The Israel Land Authority has 22 seats. It gives 10 of them to the Jewish National Fund. The Jewish National Fund explicitly develops land for the use of Jews. It says explicitly not for the use of all Israeli citizens, but for the use of Jews, right? Which helps explain why majority Palestinian towns inside Israel proper, I'm not talking about the West Bank now, are much, much more overcrowded than majority Jewish areas because they never are given the land in which to expand. And it's also why Palestinians end up having to build illegally because the Israeli Land Authority doesn't allocate land to them, right? And then most of the home demolitions inside Israel proper are of Palestinians. Imagine how equal American Jews would feel if 93% of the land in this country was controlled by a state authority that gave almost half its seats to an entity that develops land in America only for Christian use, right? So even in Israel proper, where Palestinians have the right to vote, it's profoundly different than the situation of different religious groups in France or Britain or Germany or Spain or wherever.
Next question.
Yes, I wonder if I could constrain you both to set aside for a moment the litany of past missed opportunities, past wrongs, past harms, and just for a second give a litany of the 5 or 10 things that you would like to see happen, positive steps prospectively.
Let's keep it to about 3 things, not 5 or 10. Give us 3 things, Michael, that you'd like to happen in line with the gentleman's question.
Internal elections in the Palestinian Authority and Hamas. Very quickly, I see October 7th not only through the lens of the 50th anniversary of the 1973 war and the fact that it was on a Jewish holiday, but also as Hamas maneuvering for the post-Mahmoud Abbas era in the West Bank. I would like to see a opening of of the Gaza Strip to Egypt so that Palestinians could travel freely to Egypt, to Saudi Arabia, wherever they may want, rather than have the constraints placed upon them. And I would like to see, frankly, a referendum. Let's take the 2008 Ehud Olmert peace agreement. And let's take the 2008 Ehud Olmert peace agreement and write it down if you say it hasn't been, and put it to a vote to see where people stand and where the Palestinian society is right now. One of the problems we have very, very quickly is that when you have a peace process, some people want to achieve peace. Some politicians want to profit by maintaining themselves infinitely in a process.
Comment from you, the three things,
sure.
Or comment on the three things mentioned by Michael.
Sure. I mean, I agree that I think Palestinians should be allowed to hold elections and to choose their own leadership. America and Israel may not like that leadership. I'm pretty sure that the Palestinians don't particularly like the leadership that the Israelis have chosen, right? And I think to have a legitimate leadership, you not only need to be able to have free elections, but also when you have the most prominent and prominent Palestinian leaders like Marwan Barghouti, who's not a member of Hamas, he's not an Islamist, sit in jail. So if you want to have a legitimate political leadership, then allow the person who's frequently referred to as the Palestinian Mandela, let him out of jail. I think I agree with Michael that I think it would be terrific for Palestinians in Gaza to be able to go to Egypt, to be able to go to Saudi Arabia, and to be able to go anywhere else. But, you know, it is worth noting that the Palestinians in Gaza are not mostly from Saudi Arabia or Egypt or anywhere else. They're mostly from what's now Israel. Most of the vast majority of Palestinians in Gaza are from families that were expelled from Israel in 1948. So it seems to me, if we believe in the right of Jews like Michael and me to be able to go to go and live in Israel after 2,000 years, right? Then Palestinians in Gaza, if we believe they should be able to leave Gaza, the first place they should be able to go is to the lands from which their families were expelled in Israel in 1948, right? And that's a basic fairness there, right? And I believe that Jews and Palestinians should live equally alongside one another in the West Bank, in Gaza, if Israeli Jews want to live in Gaza, and indeed in Israel proper, again, most the place from which most Palestinians in Gaza were expelled.
Michael has mentioned the 2008 offer by Yehuda Brock. So could you address that, please?
Sure. One of the reasons that the Palestinian, I mean, first of all, one person who we know profoundly opposes that offer from Ehud Olmert is Benjamin Netanyahu and everyone in his government, because he actually explicitly refused to continue those negotiations on the basis of the Olmert offer when he became prime minister in 2009. One of the reasons that if you look at Bernard Abishai's long essay in the New York Times Magazine, for instance, about the 2007-2008 negotiations, what you'll see is that one of the big sticking points, the reason that Mahmoud Abbas and the Palestinians had a problem with the Olmert offer, just to go to the question of settlements, was that Olmert wanted to annex the settlement of Ariel. I'd encourage you to go look at a map of the West Bank and the settlement of Ariel if you don't think settlements matter and for the two-state solution. The Ariel cuts through the West Bank, deep into the West Bank, essentially bisecting the northern West Bank cities of Qalqilia and Tul Karim off from the rest of the West Bank, which creates massive contiguity problem for a Palestinian state. And the more you incentivize settlers to move there, the further you are away. The Palestinians have made their own offers. They made their offers in 2000, and they made offers again. Their offers have always been that Israel can only annex about 2% of the West Bank. Olmert wanted Israel to annex about 6%. Barak wanted Israel to annex 9%. And the reason the Israeli offers are so much higher is Israel is trying to incorporate all of these settlements that Israel has subsidized and built, some of which create real contiguity problems for a Palestinian state.
Next question, please.
Thank you. One for Michael and one for Peter.
The only one question.
Okay, same question for both of them.
What? Who are you addressing it to?
Same question for both of us.
Yeah, same question. One question, please.
On the question of violence of struggling oppressed population, this is of great interest to me because of the kind of interesting triangle that we have here. The Indian struggle was largely peaceful and nonviolent. The American struggle was violent. The Jewish struggle was violent. Zionist terrorism. You haven't addressed Zionist terrorism in the 1940s, the assassination of British officials and the bombings, nor have you addressed the debate between the Irish and the Indians about what is the correct strategy to struggle against the colonial power. Should violence be used, as the Irish suggested, or should it be renounced, as Gandhi said?
Should violence be used, or should it be denounced? Is that your question? By the Palestinians, should it be used or be denounced?
Are you with Gandhi, or are you with
should violence be used, or should it be denounced?
Look, I think ethically, nonviolence is far preferable to violence, especially violence that targets civilians. But if you just say that, right, it's an empty slogan. To make that meaningful, you have to support nonviolence, right? And the problem we have is that the American government has systematically, fiercely fought against and defeated many Palestinian efforts at nonviolence, right? Palestinians have gone to the United Nations. They've gone to the International Criminal Court, the International Court of Justice. They've asked for boycotts and divestments and sanctions, which is in the tradition of the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa. In 2018, there was a largely nonviolent march of return in Gaza, in which Israeli soldiers were stationed at the fence and shot Palestinians, largely in the knees and below, creating so many amputees that Gaza created an amputee soccer team. So it's really empty, right, to say that Palestinians should act nonviolently when you criminalize Palestinian boycotts, you impose sanctions on the International Criminal Court, and you shoot nonviolent protesters, right? Then, in fact, your words about wanting Palestinians to be nonviolent sound very empty to me.
Coming from you, Michael.
Very quickly, there's got to be consequences to the decision to embrace violence. There cannot be endless do-overs to hope that we might get it right the next time that we attack or so forth. It's important to remember on October 7th, the communities that were attacked were among Israel's most left-wing, pro-peace communities. And that was deliberate. That was a deliberate decision to show that peace, despite what some diplomats might say, that wasn't on Hamas's agenda. Very, very quickly, it's also important to remember that every single Palestinian tribe, including those from Gaza, trace their routes to the Hejaz. So it's simply historically inaccurate to pretend that this migration has never existed and it's only been unidirectional. It's also important to recognize when we look at the map of the state of Israel that at its narrowest point, Israel is 8 miles wide. You're going to have a very difficult topography when you do have that two or three state solution.
I wanted to fulfill my promise to either debater to put a question to the other. You've had a lot of questions. Is there anything, first of all, Peter, a question that you would like to put to Michael at this moment, or you want to waive the privilege?
I guess what I would say is, you know, this film, which won the Oscar called No Other Land, is about a place called Masafer Yatta, where I've also spent time. The people of Masafer Yatta have been living for many, many years with the prospect that all of their homes, their entire village, will be bulldozed and destroyed. In fact, there have been many other villages in Area C of the West Bank where that's been happening. No one has accused those people of committing terrorism or taking up arms or anything. It just happens that they're in Area C of the West Bank, where Israel doesn't want any Palestinians to be able to live because they want to crowd Palestinians into the Palestinian population.
Is there a question in there?
Yeah. So my question is Michael, I'm curious if the people of Masafer Yatta were here, how you would explain to them that their oppression is not systematic and profound.
It's not systematic and profound, Peter, because when you have a situation in which you're trying to draw a border between two competing claimants, both of which have valid claims, the fact of the matter is people are going to fall on both sides of the border. Some people are going to choose to move. What I would note, and this is overwhelmingly, that Arabs are choosing to move into Israeli-controlled territory or Israel proper rather than vice versa. They're voting with their feet rather than with a pundit's pen.
Michael, would you like to put a question to Peter, or do you want to waive the honor and just wait for your summary? Any question to Peter?
You know, I think I'll actually waive the privilege because brevity is also a virtue.
Okay, thank you. All right. Yes. Forgive me, what did you say? Well, excuse me. No, well, yes, I understand. No, we're actually run out of time for the Q&A, and we now go to the summary portion of the evening. You each have 5 minutes to make your summary. According to Oxford-style rules, affirmative goes first on the summary. You can take the podium or you can do it from the chair, whichever you want to do, Peter.
Sure. You know, on one of my first, I think these conversations can be kind of clinical and abstract. On one of my first trips to the West Bank, I met a woman who had two children, two girls, and then they had a boy. And she told me that when she had a boy, her girls, who were, I don't know, eight, six, eight, ten, or whatever, burst into tears. And they burst into tears because in their village, boys throw stones at the Israeli military, right, which is an occupying army. And then the Israeli military then goes in the middle of the night into the homes of people who have families that have boys. They don't necessarily really know who threw the stone, but they know that if they grab some teenage boy, maybe they can, and they can, because they know they can hold him without a lawyer, without his family, for 1, 2, 3 days. According to the center which works on Palestinian minors, that oftentimes there's physical abuse during these interrogations, that they can get information about who maybe did throw the stone, right? And the boys come back to their homes. As you can imagine, if any of you have 12 or 13 or 14 year olds, you can imagine what a life impairing experience that was. And so these girls knew that that was going to happen in their home too. And so they started to cry when their brother was born, right? Again, we can the problem with talking about abstractions is it tends to erase the humanity of the people we're talking about. People who are every bit as human, every bit as thoughtful, every bit as sophisticated, every bit as funny, every bit as articulate as Michael and I. When I was in Masafer Yatta and Susia, and I saw people living day after day, waking up and wondering, when are the bulldozers going to come? When are they going to bulldoze all of the buildings, all of the houses, all in my village, and I'm going to be made homeless, right? That is a systematic and profound form of oppression. And people can justify it and dress it up and talk about all kinds of things. But I'm just telling you, every single person I know who has gone to the West Bank and interacted with Palestinians in a human way, not as a soldier, as a settler, but trying to listen to Palestinians and engage with them as equals, no matter how Zionist they are, no matter how deep their background in terms of supporting Israel, come away from that experience profoundly shaken and changed. In the same way that people would have if they had gone to apartheid South Africa, or they'd gone to Mississippi in the 1940s, when you hold a group of people without the most basic fundamental rights and they live under a state that can take their land, their property, their time, their children, their grandparents, their lives with utter impunity, it is more brutal than we can imagine sitting here in these privileged circumstances. Michael is a smart guy. He's a thoughtful guy. I know personally he's a decent guy, but he is defending that system of oppression.
Okay, thank you. 5 minutes of summary for you. You can take the podium or take it from the chair.
No, I'll do it from the chair.
Okay, sure. Go ahead.
When Peter says someone is a smart guy, it's almost like a Southern belle saying, bless your heart. But where Peter and I disagree on this is Peter is trying to reduce the confines of this debate to a military and a territorial dispute in the West Bank or the Gaza Strip and apply it to all of Israel in order to amplify his thesis, the affirmation of the resolution. But the fact of the matter is, Israeli citizens do not face profound discrimination in Israel proper. And the fact that Israel differentiates between what is Israel versus what is not Israel is actually profound, a profound symptom of Israel's democracy, of its internal questioning, and of its inward looking. Now, many Palestinians don't want to grow up to throw stones. Again, one of Peter and my basic differences in this debate is this notion about whether Palestinians have agency or not. I happen to believe they do. But what I find unfortunate is many of the Palestinians from Gaza who were having jobs in Israel used their opportunity to conduct surveillance that led directly to October 7th. And that, of course, was a deliberate strategy on the part of Hamas to drive the wedge deeper. That itself is unfortunate. When it comes to the West Bank, Peter, like I, have gone to the West Bank. I've also sat through lectures about Holocaust denial, in favor of Holocaust denial. But I don't make this mistake of applying those lectures from Palestinian officials to the entire Palestinian people. The fact of the matter is, every individual has agency, and actions have consequences. And policies, when one undertakes them, they have ramifications, and we can't pretend that those ramifications don't exist. If there was not a constant fear of terrorism, the situation would be much better than it is right now. Let's not forget why, for example, the West Bank border wall and fence was built. And it was proposed, of course, by Nobel laureate Yitzhak Rabin. It was to reduce suicide bombing by 99%. Sometimes separation, good fences make good neighbors. And in this, I do think that if only Palestinian civil society in the West Bank, and to the extent that Hamas allows it in the Gaza Strip, were able to concentrate on their own agency, on their own development, the situation for Palestinians writ large would be much better. Again, Peter doesn't like when I try to, Peter's a very smart guy, but he, bless your heart, but he doesn't like when I try to expand the confines of the debate between one microcosm and the whole. But again, as someone who spent a lot of time in Iraq, in Al-Anbar, Fallujah and Ramadi destroyed themselves in insurgency. They justified that insurgency against Shia, against Kurds, against Americans, against whomever. And it was only when they had a come to Muhammad moment and decided enough of this, we're going to build up our own society, that I can take my daughter now at 9 years old and drive around Ramadi and Fallujah without security. Just one final anecdote, since I have a minute left. My daughter, when she came to Baghdad with me and environs during COVID, met an Ayatollah, and she called him Rabbi. And he looked at her and said, I'm Rabbi, I'm an Ayatollah. And without missing a beat, with all the diplomatic muster of a nine-year-old, she said, if you don't want to be called Rabbi, you probably shouldn't dress like one. The point of this is there actually is a future, and we just need to hold people accountable and understand that individual choices create individual results.
Thank you, Michael. Yeah. I have in my hand the Soul Forum Tootsie Roll that goes to the winner of the actual style voting. Please open the voting. Please go back into your cell phones and vote yes, no, or undecided on the resolution. The oppression of Palestinians in non-democratic Israel has been systematic and profound. Please vote yes, no, or undecided on the resolution. While you are voting, I want again to invite all of you, even though who haven't as yet paid, but who will be paying tomorrow morning, to the reception. Questions that you might have wanted to put to these debaters, you'll probably be able to put to them at the reception. Plenty of great food there, just right across the street. It's called the Tower and Crown. Just follow just diagonally sort of in that direction. It's a very narrow street. You'll no doubt find it. We have that place ready for the reception. The Soul Forum is going to continue its monthly debates. We do 12 debates a year, one every month. We are taking our show on the road on April 26th. We are going to a libertarian convention, the New Hampshire Liberty Forum. If you go on our website, you can buy tickets to that three-day forum. We will be up there sponsoring a particular debate. But back in New York, most interestingly, we will have a debate on immigration between Dave Smith and Alex Narasta. That will be at the Sheen Center, our Yoma home, on Wednesday, May 21st. About three quarters of that hall has already sold out. My mic is not working? Oh, my God. Thank you. Oh, my God, it's working now. Yeah. Well, okay. Well, I hope you heard some of it. The debate voting is continuing, and I have in my hand the Seoul Forum Tootsie Roll. I am announcing debates in the future. On Wednesday, May 21st, we will have a debate about immigration between Dave Smith and Alex Narasta. I urge you, if you'd like to attend that debate at the Sheen Center, to buy your tickets over the next day or two, because we do expect to sell that one out. Sheen Center is even larger, but Dave Smith has a very popular podcast, and he keeps advertising that debate on his podcast, and I think that's what has been selling out the tickets. In June, we have not yet posted it, but we will be having a debate about the Cold War. Maybe some of you have heard of the Cold War. It's something that ended in 1991 and began in the late 1940s. And we were going to have a debate between two eminent scholars on the Cold War, and that will be June 19th. We haven't yet posted that, but watch for it, because I think that too will be very well attended. Lucas, how are we doing on the voting? Do we have the results yet? Do we know who's going to win the Tootsie Roll? Lucas, are you there? One more minute. Okay. Again.
Suspense is killing me.
Excuse me?
Suspense is killing me.
All right. I want to thank both debaters for an extremely courteous debate. Levin with Neumer. I also want to say that, of course, the Oxford-style voting is just a game, but these Tootsie Rolls come at great value. The eBay value of this Seoul Forum Tootsie Roll is way in excess of what you can pay for it on the free market. And there are those who, of course, value the Tootsie Roll greatly, and I'm filling time. And where do we stand, Lucas? Still another minute. Lucas? Oops, I see him coming down the stairs. Be careful, Lucas. Please do not. Okay. Okay. My God. Oh, wow. This only happened once before. The oppression of Palestinians in non-democratic Israel has been systematic and profound. The yes vote went from 62.64% to 70.33%. It picked up 7.69% of the vote. The no vote went from 16.48 to 24.18. It too picked up 7.69% of the vote. This happened once before. We will have to split this Tootsie Roll between the two of them. Congratulations to you both. I will say, just to give you information, that the yes vote ended up with 70.33. The no vote ended up with 24.18. So if we only did a final vote, we would think that the yes vote won. However, it's a perfect tie because both picked up the same share of vote down to the decimal point. Congratulations to you both. The Tootsie Roll will be divided, and we'll see at the resolution the reception afterwards.
Thank you. Thanks. Thank you very much. Thank you.